Hey, Avi.
Hey, Maya.
So I've been thinking a lot about emergencies lately and a lot of the different emergencies that surround us right now.
What's the most emergency situation that you've been in personally?
Last year, I had a really traumatic surgery that was completely out of nowhere.
Wow.
And I think there were so many scary aspects of it that as a person who does justice work, I knew that, you know, racism was in the healthcare system. I knew that people didn't listen to women, but I didn't know it personally. And so for me, when I was, you know, realizing that I was going to have emergency surgery and was being rushed to the hospital, so many things went through my mind when I got into the ER. One was that I was incapable of speaking to a healthcare worker.
Mm-hmm.
I was incapable of like handing over my medical documents to tell people what I was feeling and what was happening. And if I hadn't had two chosen family members there who were protecting me in every conceivable way.
And know you well enough to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To advocate for me. I can't imagine, and who know my entire medical history and mm-hmm. knew exactly what to do. I know now that I would be dead. And I keep thinking, you know, how that situation would have been different if I didn't speak English, or if I was trans, or if I had been 5 minutes later. And, you know, after that, when I was basically bedridden for almost 2 full months, unable to, like, go to shower or be alone with myself. And if I hadn't had a community around, I have no idea what would have happened.
Was that your takeaway from going through that? How vulnerable we are and how dependent we are on the mesh of humans around us?
Oh, definitely. My biggest takeaway was how we have neglected community. Because when I tell the story to other people, the number one thing they say is, thank God you had people around you. I don't even know if I have that right now.
Right.
How about you?
So after university, I worked in restaurants for years, saved up all my money and went traveling. Pretty standard issue, first world story right now. And I ended up in Nepal and I was trekking and I fell. Mm-hmm. I fell on a hillside. I was 20 years old. I was alone, which was so dumb.
You're 20 years old.
Yeah, right. I said that. I'm lucky to be alive in a number of related ways. Mm-hmm. So I remember kind of stumbling and then slipping, and then it was a slide, and then I was grabbing branches that were breaking off of my hand, and then the ground behind the hillsides like cut back. So then I was just free falling, and I fell like 50 feet.
50 feet.
Yeah. And I was in the air long enough to think, I remember thinking, what am I supposed to think about? Because this is my last thought. Mm-hmm. I thought about my family, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I hit and my leg shattered. My ankle was a jigsaw puzzle. My tibia was split vertically.
Oof.
The bone didn't come through the skin. I would have bled out
yeah.
before I was ever found. I wasn't found for like 8 hours. And I was wrapped around a tree with my leg just swinging there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing that happened was this tidal wave of pain, and it just blotted out everything. And I was clinging to consciousness because I knew if I let go or passed out and gave in to the pain that I would fall further and I would definitely be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this just a swirling miasma of this adrenaline and pain whiteout. But I discovered in myself the first clear thought that I had coming out of I was still in the state of emergency, but coming out of the helplessness mm-hmm. moment was a determination to survive, an actual will to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned something about myself that I didn't know I had. And as we've been thinking and talking and working on states of emergency, there's this vast difference between the personal experience of emergency and the big collective emergencies, the climate crisis, inequality, racism, that we spend a lot of our waking lives, you know, trying to do something about. And they don't map exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because the big ones are, some of them are slow motion, they're grinding, they're perpetual. How do we get that emergency response on the big ones? I think that's the question of our time in a way.
Yeah. How do we activate a collective emergency?
Can you tell me right now?
Maybe stay tuned.
Okay. I'm Avi Lewis.
I'm Maya Menezes.
And you're listening to Change Everything, a podcast by people who are freaking out about climate, racism, and inequality, and thinking through solutions that are as big as the crises we face.
This week, we're talking about the Green New Deal. We'll speak with Varshini Prakash, one of the founders of the Sunrise Movement in the U.S.
And we'll discuss the opportunities and challenges of bringing the Green New Deal frame to Canada. But first, I feel like we should talk a little bit about why we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, so Avi, why are you doing this?
Well, I spend a lot of time ranting at my screens, like everybody.
Shocking.
Yes. But I feel in this particular political moment in Canada, there's just this vast disconnect between the way issues are being discussed in the corporate media and the actual urgency and the scale of change that's required to deal with our various emergencies. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like there's a lot of space for conversations where we can unpack and try to do a little light deconstructing, breaking down of the big conversations in the country, and pull in people whom we know through our various networks who are organizing on the front lines of different social issues and who have real expertise in what solutions look like to the big crises. Mm-hmm. and share some knowledge. And, you know, I kind of think about it as breaking down what is and building up what should be. What about you?
I think I've been in a constant state of panic and stress for the last couple of years.
Wow, that's terrific. Good to know.
Yeah,
Thanks for sharing.
It's not like anything's triggering it. But, you know, I'm really frustrated at how movements feel, like for me right now, very far away from each other. Mm-hmm. I think we're in this constant state of panic about, you know, losing the bare minimum. We're fighting against cuts to everything all at once. We're witnessing climate reach this level where we're seeing what we were told would be the worst case scenario for so long that I don't think we believed it.
So much sooner, yeah.
So much sooner. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, people, movements are not working in conjunction with one another like we used to. And so I want this podcast to actually kind of be a bridge for people who understand that connections are there, have known it all their lives, but need to be inspired to be brave, because I think that's what this moment really demands of us, right? Is to be brave and to connect with each other and figure out the interconnections of our shared liberation. And so I want to pull folks together that are drawing those connections, that are doing the work on the ground, and kind of facilitate talking about what we need to win. I don't think we talk about what we need to win.
Well, that's the solutions conversation.
Yeah.
And we should also probably be clear that for now, anyway, this podcast is an election year experiment in Canada, particularly provoked by the fact that climate, for once, is on the table mm-hmm. as an election issue. It could be the defining election issue, but the way that the Liberals and Conservatives federally are debating it, it's like this big fake-ass debate about a carbon price, which is only like one policy. Climate scientists have come together and said, we've got 12 years to get our emissions in half, which implies, and they explicitly say, changing all of our systems. Mm. So, yeah, I think there's something a little out of touch about the political conversation this year in Canada, and it needs breaking down.
Yeah, I did. I actually did air quotations when you said debate.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. And, you know, but at the same time, there's also a huge movement momentum, right? We're in a lot of different places that's getting a whole lot of no coverage.
Right.
We've got, you know, a migrant rights network in Canada launching that is
nationally.
Nationally. Like, I've never seen that happen before at mm-hmm. this scale. Like, days of action planned across the country. We've got this year in 2019, Power Shift has been revived. The youth convergence of activists, organizers, campaigners, it's back. Don't call it a comeback. That's, I think, really indicative of the political moment that we're in.
So I guess it's fair to do more disclosure
yes.
at the outset here.
So I guess it's the first episode. We should be honest that we both work together at The Leap,
which is a small organization that came out of the organizing around the Leap Manifesto in 2015, which you were not working with us at that point.
No, I wasn't.
And yet you've had to tell the origin story and over.
Yes.
What's you tell it?
The Leap Manifesto came out of a gathering.
What was it?
15 with 15 different points, a convergence of different activists, organizers.
Dozens of people from all around the country.
From a lot of different movements who came together to write this document collaboratively, mm-hmm. Calling for a complete systems overhaul and change. Really inspiring.
15 political demands to get the country off fossil fuels in a hurry, in a way that would attack inequality and racism at the root. Mm-hmm. And obviously there have been a number of political explosions that the Leap set off in different spaces in the country. But what it did for us was actually let us know that there's a huge appetite for an analysis that connects the dots among issues, mm-hmm. and for coalition work that brings people together across their silos, because we're going to have to build a whole lot of power to win in the time frame and the scale of the crises we face. Mm-hmm. And none of and the system is so efficient at keeping us in our issue boxes.
Yep.
So a lot of the Leap's work is connecting the dots, both in framing and communications and public education, but also convening people and bringing them together like we did in that original gathering. Mm-hmm. It was the convening was like the glue, the magic that launched the Leap Manifesto, and it surely will be the secret to the Green New Deal. All right, so let's get into the Green New Deal and start with the story of how it's exploded into our consciousness and what it is.
Well, our guests will explain more, but basically it's a sweeping effort to transform all of our systems. You know, how we get around, how we get our food, our energy, manufacturing, housing, everything, to get our greenhouse gas emissions down as quickly as we need to. And really to create as many good jobs as we can in the process.
It's an idea that's been around in various forms and coming from different political orientations for years. I believe Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist.
Yes, noted activist.
Noted neoliberal activist may have coined the term, but it's exploded into the conversation, not just in climate circles, but way beyond, just in the last few months.
And it's really building on the long-standing work by grassroots groups like the Climate Justice Alliance, who advanced the principle that the solutions to the climate crisis are to be found in the communities on the front lines of climate change.
So the current political moment started with this weird confluence of events this past fall.
Now to a dire warning about climate change.
An urgent warning tonight from some of the world's top scientists.
The UN panel says governments around the world must take rapid action to curb rising temperatures.
We have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
In October, the world's leading climate scientists, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, put out a report as part of the follow-up to the Paris negotiations, the Paris climate process. And it was about the difference in the impact of limiting global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius versus 1.5 degrees.
And it turns out that half a degree really makes a difference.
What do you know? We've both been in these climate conferences, and delegations from the Global South have been chanting for years in the corridors, 1.5 to stay alive. So it turns out that even if the U.S. hadn't pulled out of Paris, the 2 degrees that governments committed to in Paris is totally inadequate. And the science is really definitive on this now. 2 degrees of temperature rise would see hundreds of millions more people exposed to poverty, hunger, water shortages, forced migration, and other climate impacts, not to mention tremendous economic costs. That's the scenario that the scientists have laid out for a 2 degree temperature rise. So the priority of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees is now clear.
And, you know, we talk a lot about global catastrophic warming. We say a lot of these words all the time, but what do they really mean? And what could it look like? For me, I think about, you know, we're talking about whole cities going underwater. We're talking about cities like Paris, like Mumbai, a huge percentage of Bangladesh, millions and millions of people. This means a global refugee and migration crisis, the likes of which we've actually never seen. And that's really saying something, because we are currently in the midst right. of the largest refugee and migration crisis we have ever seen. So in fact, many of these impacts are already hitting. We know this to be true. We see this really, and I see this really, exemplified in the migrant caravan. Mm-hmm. Migration is a climate issue.
And now the scientists are saying with great clarity that even though the world is nowhere near on track to meet that 2 degree target, we have to get massively more ambitious, like yesterday.
The IPCC report says also that we have 12 years to get global emissions down almost by half, to have a chance of avoiding that, you know, worst case disaster movie day after tomorrow version of climate change.
So here's where the scientists go a step further and start talking about what would be required to get off this path to 2 degrees and the disaster that it entails. There's a quote in the document that leapt off the page at me. Well, I feel like it is sort of the scientists channeling the Leap Manifesto, as self-serving as that sounds. the scientists say, we have to change everything. Here's the quote that to me says it all. Getting on a path to 1.5 degrees would require rapid and far-reaching transitions in energy, land, urban, infrastructure, transport and buildings, and industrial systems. The report calls the scale of the transition required unprecedented, and it is transformative.
The report makes it clear that it is absolutely possible to cut emissions that fast and that much. It will just require changing everything.
There you go. So the report comes out in October, and then something else unprecedented happened. The U.S. midterm elections, in which a bunch of insurgent democratic socialists, part of this democratic socialist revival in the United States, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, were elected. They ran primary challenges against established kind of corporate Democrats. They won their nominations, and then they won in the midterm elections. And there are a number of them who are young politicians who really made climate change and climate action their number one issue.
Climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life, not just as a nation, but as a world. And in order for us to combat that threat, we must be as ambitious and innovative in our solution as possible.
But as we know, behind every inspiring politician is an inspired social movement. And for the past year or so, this group of young climate activists and organizers known as the Sunrise Movement have been putting the idea of a Green New Deal front and center. And, you know, right after the election, they occupied Nancy Pelosi's office on Capitol Hill, and they demanded a special House committee to define a Green New Deal.
We don't have time for any more excuses. We need the real solutions to the climate crisis. Am I right?
Yeah!
We need the real solutions to the climate crisis as mandated by science and justice. And that means a rapid wartime economic mobilization to transition our economy and our society over the next 12 years. So we're here to say to our politicians, we need you. We need you to back a Green New Deal.
That was Varshini Prakash, a co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. She was speaking to those hundreds of young activists in the halls of U.S. Congress last December.
And we're thrilled to have Varshini join the conversation. Hey.
Hi, Varshini.
Hi, y'all. Good to be here.
I want to start with that. We played that clip from you know, you on the megaphone inside the halls of power. And take us inside Pelosi's office for that moment. What was that day like?
Yeah, it was so powerful. I mean, there was the one that we did on November 13th, which sort of really skyrocketed the Green New Deal and this urgent and ambitious call for climate action in line with what the latest science called for, that happened on that date. And then just a month later, we came back with, I think, four times as many young people as we had on November 13th, on December 10th, again, to call for democratic leadership and the politicians of our time to really, frankly, treat the crisis with as much seriousness as our generation was taking it. It was incredible. I mean, it was like to see young people from the ages of 7 years old standing up and defiantly calling, unabashedly calling for the action that we needed. It was terrifying in many ways to go up against some of the most powerful politicians in our nation. And also just, you know, the role of shepherding so many people along this process of, you know, a lot of them risked and then were arrested in that second action. Over 100 young people were, in fact, arrested for civil disobedience, calling for a Green New Deal.
This is such a far-reaching idea. What is a Green New Deal?
So a Green New Deal, the way that we conceive of it, is an umbrella term for a set of programs and policies that get America off fossil fuels fast to an 100% renewable energy economy and ensure economic prosperity for all in the process. So it includes specific things, particularly for the United States, like moving to an 100% renewable energy economy that leaves no one behind by 2030, which is what the latest UN climate scientists have called for. It involves things like the creation of tens of millions of good, high-paying jobs doing the work of averting climate catastrophe. And for us, a really, really important and central pillar of a Green New Deal involves ensuring that racial and economic equity are at the core of any Green New Deal. So this says that we need a just transition for workers in the fossil fuel sector. We need to ensure that communities of color and working families who are already experiencing the impacts of a warming world are not left behind in the transition, and that we're pouring investment to those communities as well.
Can I ask you to do a little public service announcement for us, as for a largely Canadian audience, for this podcast, and just give us a brief on the original New Deal of the 1930s and how you see it playing into the Green New Deal today?
So the New Deal was a set of programs and policies largely passed under FDR's administration back in the 1930s, like you talked about, that
the old Franklin Delano Roosevelt fellow.
Sorry.
That president guy.
So this was really putting forward a worldview and a framework, and passed a number of policies and programs really aimed at getting the middle class and working people out of the Great Depression that had absolutely decimated communities and families in the decade preceding. And so we saw the creation of things like Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. We saw increasing and expanded labor protections for workers. We saw the minimum wage standards being created, and so many more other things that were really around this worldview and this developing this common sense of what government should do, who it should be for, and who it should protect. And, you know, there's this famous thing that FDR actually ran on called the Second Bill of Rights, which very concretely just lays out that every American, every person has the right to a good job, good medical care, a home. And some of these basic things that have really been lost, I think, from American politics over a few decades after we saw the rise of Reaganism and the, you know, neoliberal policies that followed suit.
So you spoke a little bit at the end of your explanation of the New Deal there about, you know, these connections between all these different aspects of life and equity have been largely missing from American politics since Reaganism. And, you know, this Green New Deal that's being presented, it's so broad and vast. It goes into multiple different movements. It's talking about intersectional, just, and strategic transitions. Can you talk a little bit about why it's actually so broad and why it's so all-encompassing?
Sure. Well, there's a few different things. One is that this is the first time in American history that a direction has been set around climate policy that's actually in line with things like the IPCC or the UN body that has been tasked with really studying the climate crisis and talking about what we need to do to avert it. And so what this... what the research around the IPCC has said is that we have quite literally 12 years to transform. This is an unprecedented level of changes to every aspect of our government and society in order to stop this crisis. And what we think is imperative in this moment is like that we can actually forever bind and tie the work of averting the climate crisis, of ensuring that we actually protects the future for all generations to come, a forever binding that also to economic prosperity, to job creation, to a healthy economy, and racial equity in the process. And we've seen time and again the way in which climate policy has been created that doesn't actually benefit communities of color or people who have been historically left out of economic prosperity in America's history. And so we see a huge opportunity right here with the Green New Deal to not only work to stop the climate crisis, but also combine that with actually creating a government and a society and starting to build back some of that into the American political system, a society that works for all people.
So you're talking a lot about justice and what science and justice require, but it strikes me that the scale of the change being demanded in the Green New Deal frame is a strategic one as well. There's way too much to be done for any one social movement or any one group of politicians to do it.
Definitely.
So it seems like you guys are invoking this frame that tells us we need to all get together across our silos and issues because that's what it's going to take. So you've got the justice part, the science part, and the strategic part of a movement of movements.
You know, for us to actually stop the climate crisis, it is not going to be one bill or piece of legislation or one branch of government that's going to do this. It's going to have to be multiple bills taking on every aspect of our economy and society, talking about how we eliminate warming emissions in every sector of society, in our industry, in our agriculture, in our transportation, in our energy, and more. It's going to look like multiple pieces of legislature over decades of time at every level of government, both the federal, the state, and the local. And that's something that we've been really clear about and very clear that from the get-go, this is not something that is just Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is not something that is just Sunrise Movement. There have been organizations, communities, indigenous communities, communities of color who have been fighting on this issue for decades. All of this is going to require thousands of groups to come together. And for us to actually achieve something like averting climate catastrophe, it'll look like both building the people power that we need, building the political power, but also creating this mass movement of movements, of think tanks, of institutions, of citizen action groups that are all sort of aligned around this common vision of society that, like, we should live in a world where basic things like our right to clean air and clean water and a safe home and a livable future are inalienable rights that we all enjoy.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what is the process going forward? Obviously, there's a lot of the policy of a Green New Deal. A lot of the policy is interrelated, and it's also super complex. It involves different levels of government. So how's all this policy going to get drafted?
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's a big question. And I, to be totally honest, I don't know that I have the full answer there. There are a lot of people who are working on this. You know, we're going to see resolutions and bills coming out from the Hill that will have various iterations of this. I think, you know, there are some exciting progressive think tanks and institutions that are going to be doing a lot of work talking to folks in the policy realm and getting economists and getting grassroots partners and organizations that have done a lot of work crafting climate policy over the years. But in all honesty, I really see the next year as an active process of defining what the Green New Deal looks like from the grassroots on up, really building in a lot of the wisdom and direct experience that frontline communities have been experiencing due to a warming world, but also the way that that has played on racialized inequality, wealth inequality in this country, and contributing those factors to our organizing effort as well. So our big goal for the next year or two is really to build the public consensus, but also the political will around the real solutions to the climate crisis as mandated by science and justice.
This is great because I think we're talking now about the interface between social movements and electoral politics. And it strikes me that that's one of the things that feels like a breakthrough in this moment, in part because you had some, you know, really left candidates who were elected, but they came out of social movements. So there's a kind of a virtuous cycle of movements, you know, starting to produce people who are ready to go into the electoral sphere and then work with movements once they're on the inside. And this combined inside-outside dynamic seems to be characteristic of this moment. So I'd love to hear some of your reflection, because I know you guys have been talking about this in the Sunrise Movement for a couple of years, about what is the relationship that you have with the politicians, with the electoral sphere. It's clear that you have allies in there. You also have crappy corporate Democrats whom you've been pressuring and negotiating with.
Honestly, part of the story of the genesis of Sunrise is based off of a couple trends that we saw in U.S. politics. One was seeing the massive, honestly nauseating influx of oil and gas money into the campaign coffers of politicians of both political parties, but in particular, the Republican Party, which has received, I think, like over 80% of the oil and gas money in both the 2016 and 2018 elections. And we've seen, you know, very obviously their full-throated support and embrace of climate denialism as a direct manifestation of what those dollars can do. And on the other side, we saw a Democratic Party that had, in many ways, paid lip service to climate action, that had avowed to do something about it, that said that it believed the science and would stand by it, and yet at the same time, action had not really proceeded further than talking about the reality of the issue. There were all these articles that came out saying how Democrats have no plan to stop the climate crisis. They don't even have a plan to make a plan.
You think that's bad? Yeah. We've got the governing party that talks a lot about being climate champions, and then they bought a pipeline for tar sands with our money.
Totally. It all comes down to really what our strategy is. For example, when I was doing work as a fossil fuel divestment campaigner, I really saw the benefit of protest and demonstration and community organizing. Those three things put together were really effective at getting the story of the climate crisis, the urgency around it, and really bringing into public consciousness what the private suffering so many Americans and people around the world were going through was. And we knew that we needed to keep that piece of it. And then, after 2016, we knew that it wasn't also going to be enough, because if we were always railing on a system that was unaccountable to us, that was just going to be exhausting and we were always going to be playing defense. And so we added this political side of things, where we wanted politicians to win or lose based off of their stance and what they're willing to do about the climate crisis. Like, that should just be a given. And so we started doing a lot of electoral work of, like, talking to people in communities, getting voters out, educating voters, getting people registered, particularly, like, permanently expanding the electorate to include more people of color and young people and working people who have often been left behind by both political parties. And so we started doing a lot of that work to kick out fossil fuel-funded politicians and also to elect climate champions to office. And when politicians get elected who are accountable to the movement, we can see so much more move, and we have a lot more leverage and power as movements to achieve the aims that we want if we're not always having to protect from the onslaught of attacks on our communities.
How do you see this moment of interface between movements and the electoral?
There's going to be a big contestation over the next year that's going to involve not just Sunrise, but what we're hoping to be, like, somewhere in the realm of, like, 3,000 to 5,000 to 7,000 citizen action groups that are actually all working in concert to help define this framework for the Green New Deal. Honestly, Avi, for this to work, lots of people are going to have to make their voices heard to our politicians, because it's still open season for how to define it in this moment. Like, there's a chance that people could define it really improperly and inequitably as well. For example, like, there are people who are trying to define the Green New Deal right now as just, let's just improve the tax code in the United States and that's the Green New Deal, or let's just insert climate change into some existing bill and call it the Green New Deal.
This working together and, you know, broad sweeping coalitions and working in concert with each other is so exciting. It's something that you were talking a lot about in Canada. It's obviously something that has largely been missing from our political landscape for many, many years. And so watching this kind of play out south of the border is so exciting and really, really inspiring, Virginie. And we hear that there is a Sunrise Roadshow on the horizon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So we are taking the Green New Deal on tour. So basically, in the last few months, we have really taken D.C. by storm. We've seen unprecedented numbers of young people coming out from the woodwork to participate in Sunrise movement and pressure their policymakers to back a Green New Deal. But we're also well aware that even though a majority of people who hear about the Green New Deal support it, of both political parties, like something like 80% of Americans haven't heard about it yet or something like that. So our goal is to spread the message about the Green New Deal as far and wide as possible, to work in concert with partners to come together for a 15-city tour that is largely going to be sharing about what the Green New Deal is, building this public consensus and the high watermark for what the Green New Deal is in the public. And it's going to be super exciting. There are going to be politicians, movement leaders, influencers, and artists. And it will be also giving young people the tools and resources to go out in their own communities and push for their politicians to back a Green New Deal and also stop taking money from the oil and gas executives that are jeopardizing our futures. So that is starting at the end of March. And if you go to sunrisemovement.org, you can find out more about it.
Amazing. It's been really exciting watching the rise and the surge of the Sunrise Movement, and it's given us a lot to think about and, frankly, a challenge to see radical politics exploding in the United States in a way that Canadians have a little bit of envy about, but also we got our work cut out for us.
We're so grateful to have you on the first episode of our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay, we got to take a quick break, which on other podcasts I think would be like a mattress commercial or something.
But something like that.
For us, it's just going to be maybe some nice music. And when we come back, we'll talk about what a Green New Deal in Canada would look like.
Starting with an apparent controversy about the name. Stay tuned.
All right, Maya. We have been talking about and thinking about a Green New Deal for Canada for a few months now.
Yeah, just a few months only.
And maybe only all the time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the name.
So some people are averse to importing it.
Yeah, I mean, we've both been in a number of meetings where people in Canada have immediately said, well, we obviously couldn't use the name because...
Not only, we can't even discuss what it could look like in Canada until we have a new name, which seems outrageous.
I mean, okay, this is a thing for me. Mm-hmm. It's the Canadian parochialism thing. Like, for years when I worked at the CBC, mm-hmm. whenever once an executive wanted to shut down an idea that was, had some political backbone to it, they'd say, we have to think about how this is going to play in Salmon Arm, or what would my grandmother in Cape Breton think about this story? It's like, your grandmother brought up a family in Cape Breton. She's a smart woman.
She's been through a lot.
Let's trust people a little bit. We don't want to sort of have a cultural importation. Mm-hmm. It does refer to something that happened under Roosevelt in the 30s. But the Green New Deal frame has been around. It is around. In Davos recently, the new Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, said to the assembled oligarchs.
But this ecological transition, which is starting to be known in many forums as the Green New Deal, should not instill fear.
There's been a Green New Deal group, the Green New Deal Working Group in the UK, economists and Green Party MPs since 2007. The European Green Party's theme song in the 2009 European elections was called the Green New Deal.
Green New Deal, we can make it happen.
Beyond all that and the potential for comedy in Green New Deal theme songs, we are going to be hearing about the Green New Deal in the abundant coverage of the American election cycle from all the Democratic presidential hopefuls who have already endorsed it. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. So we're like, come on, people. We can just use the name. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. It's a name. It's a thing. Let's just use it.
Wonderful.
Let's talk about the substantive stuff around the Canadian challenges and opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, and Varshini really talked about the urgency of the movement folks defining the Green New Deal, so making sure that it's not watered down, which is something that we should be rightfully very afraid of in Canada. Big NGOs, especially environmental and non-governmental organizations, when they jump in and they take hold of movement messaging and they water it down so quickly that the work that needs to go in to build it back up is astronomical. And so getting movement folks involved in that now so that it has that high watermark is so incredibly important.
Agreed. And I think that the high watermark is a great image that Varshini used, and I think we should adopt it. For me, I've got my top four things that I think a Green New Deal has to include in Canada.
Let us have the rant.
Let me run them by you. So you just stop me if something feels totally wrong here. But first of all, it has to solve the problems we face. Mm-hmm. We need solutions on the scale of the problems we face. So the 12-year challenge of transforming all of our economic, industrial, manufacturing, transportation, and other systems, a Green New Deal has to actually offer a solution on scale and at speed. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one. The next one is that we have to insist on radical inclusivity.
So everyone's saying those words all the time. What does that even mean for you?
Well, the New Deal in the United States in the 30s was the birth of redlining, for instance, a racist practice of creating black neighborhoods. People of color and women and immigrants were excluded from a lot of the huge public programs in the original New Deal.
Which totally ended and now everything's fine.
Right. Yeah. Which was part of a continuity that pre-existed. And yeah, but like a lot of current practices started in the original New Deal that are repulsive. And so the notion of this time for everyone is utterly critical. And I think for obviously because it's just because it's morally right, but also as we were talking a little bit with Varshini, that it's strategic too. Mm-hmm. We need to build the power across different issues to make something of this scale happen. And therefore we have to make sure that everyone's at the table when we do the vision. I think the other thing that the Green New Deal is a reset and a new opportunity to do is something that environmentalism and the climate movement has not been doing yet and has allowed a lot of our opponents, political opponents, to pretend that there's a conflict between the economy and environmental concerns, or that the environment and the economy can be taken care of together, as you know, our prime minister says, by buying pipelines, you know.
Oh, God.
But it has to meet people where they're at. And it has to offer tangible improvements to the material conditions of working people in their lives. Mm-hmm. And this is why the federal jobs guarantee, anyone who needs to work, anyone who wants to work, anyone who's able to work, must have a job. Because if we're going to transform everything, the government is going to, we're not going to have enough people to do it. And there's going to be too much work to do. And so the premise in the United States of a federal jobs guarantee is that there will be a job for everybody and it must be a living wage job. And as much as possible, it must encourage unionization and worker organization. And, you know, so that people can see that it's going to actually make their lives better. And this has been missing from the offer on climate action for a long time. So this is a new opportunity. And then the other one for me, the number four, is don't trust anyone who sits at their keyboard and invents the whole thing. like the Leap Manifesto, there has to be a broad, inclusive people's process to define what a Green New Deal looks like for various communities. It needs to be an opportunity to sit together, but it also can't be some guy, and it's usually a guy who just goes, I know what it is, and puts out a thing. And
do men do that?
Never, but yes.
We have so much problem also in Canada when we talk about sharing practices or working collaboratively on things. Everyone is so protective of their own language, of the things that they're working on. It's literally pulling teeth to get people to talk about what worked and what didn't work, how they message things to their supporters, what they think needs to be in this document, and coming to fight for it together. You know, and that is the biggest strength of, I think, what came out of the Leap Manifesto with that collaborative process, is that when it was finished, everyone could see their mark on it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you're dedicated to it. You want to push it as a collective. But, you know, like, let's talk about what peer review means in the movement,
right.
You know?
Beautiful.
Like, let's do open source. Let's share it. I'm really hoping that collaborative process is something that comes back in a big way. And I see this framework as something that can allow that to happen.
It is such a big idea that there's not only space for everyone, but we need everyone to define it. So I also think the Green New Deal is the right idea at the right time. We don't have this electric momentum in Canada around this idea the way there is in the States right now.
Yeah.
And there are real challenges, which we'll talk about in a sec, about whether or not, you know, this can be imported successfully.
Yeah.
But I think it might be the right idea at the right time for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is an election year. The climate debate is going to be happening in the mainstream. It's too narrow. It's too performative. But we have an opportunity around what real climate action looks like after what will be 4 years of Trudeau, who betrayed every promise, major promise, progressive promise he made to get elected, and climate signal among them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, it is the perfect time to be reframing what this means to get young people involved and really pushing back on this frame that the Liberal seems to have, for example, that if we don't just throw down behind them, the alternative is going to kill us.
Yeah.
So I actually got into a fight with Catherine McKenna at this year's COP, the Conference of the Parties.
Our environment and climate change minister.
That's her.
Okay.
We had the youth delegation. We were all sitting down to have a conversation with her, as we usually do. And, you know, what we wanted to do and what we do as a youth delegation is we draw these connections. We let politicians know. We understand that an attack on unions and legislating people back to work, making sure that young people don't have a viable access to a future, the purchasing of pipelines, the closing of the border. We understand these to be a direct attack on a just transition. And this is a direct go back on the promises that they made to get elected in the first place.
Right.
And the response, of course, from McKenna was, you know, well, if you don't, you know, blindly throw down behind us, then you're going to be sorry. You're going to have a worse government. And is that the message we want to be mobilizing with? Absolutely not. I hope not. But the exciting thing about this for me is that intersectionality. How many times have we said that now?
Not too many, I hope.
Not enough and too many,
yeah.
Okay. Intersectionality is really built into the Green New Deal in a really tangible way. It actually forces us to come into the room together. And this is, you know, the most frustrating thing for me. I know I go on about this all the time, but we have forgotten how to build coalitions. And a Green New Deal forces us to have to build coalitions from the get-go.
We're going to need the collective brilliance and wisdom and experience and organizing muscle of everybody to fashion this vision. And that's a huge opportunity that suits this moment.
And I think we need to do something that we are really bad at doing on the left, which is get in front of the right with this type of messaging. We know that this type of, you know, work can be used to turn people against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be prepared for that in advance. And that means sitting down at tables and sitting down with each other in good faith as fast as we possibly can.
And it's not going to happen if it's just within the social movement universe.
Exactly.
What's clear from talking to Varshini, from looking at what's going on in the United States, is there's kind of a theory of change emerging, which I think is being more and more broadly shared, that if you believe the science, that there's 12 years to transition every system in our society, you know, it's pretty much only a nation state that can issue a currency, you know, because we're going to need to print money and pay for things and change the taxation system to do this. But there isn't a government in the world that we would trust with this. And the political discourse is so narrow. The solutions on offer are so paltry and they're so rigorously policed by our stenographer class, by the mainstream media who so, you know, gleefully repeat the frames that the politicians use. We need the creativity and the radicalism of social movements to explode the conversation, to make much bigger policy demands possible and hold the political class to account. So this interface between movements and a new electoral front is clearly implied by a Green New Deal. And again, that's the opportunity and challenge. But I think more and more people are reaching the moment where they realize we can't just hold ourselves aloof from the electoral process, just in the same way for many, many years we've recognized that we can't put all our faith in it.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it complicated in a way in Canada, in that, you know, I see movement folks maybe for the first time in at least since I've been organizing, talking about intervening in elections, which is like, to make no mistake, this is a radical change in how people are feeling, how movement folks are feeling about participating in elections. But I think that there's an element of panic and guilt that is driving a lot of that.
Ooh, tell me more.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of like where I'm like, I have a little bit of a different view about why. And I think it's because the movement distanced itself so far from politics and really just denounced any type of participation in the state. And like,
when you say the movement, that's a big monolithic term, and I know you don't think of it that way. So who are you talking about? More specific.
I'm talking about frontline organizers who reject the state of Canada, right? People who are fighting for Indigenous sovereignty, solidarity, land defense, also people who are rejecting the concept of borders on the concept of stolen land.
Mm-hmm.
Folks who are talking about pathways to access and status and fighting cuts to essential services from governments that they don't recognize, but recognize that people need access to services to live healthy, full lives. So when I say the movement, it is a very big encompassing word, but I feel like staying out of elections, I felt really good. And, you know, it really leaves, it allows you to live your theory of politics.
Right.
And I think what we're all realizing is that is an incredible privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really uncomfortable concept to sit with. It means that while we were all doing other work and staying out of elections, far right-wing governments were elected, and now people are going to suffer.
Yeah.
And people are dying.
Yeah.
And so we can't actually afford to completely denounce the political spectrum. We actually need to get involved, and we need to run candidates that want to do good things.
One of the things I predict will happen, or I hope will happen, as we start debating the Green New Deal, both within organizations and the social movement space, but increasingly in the mainstream, I hope, and even in the electoral space, is that we'll provoke a big ideological battle about why government exists and the role of finance and banks and the financialization of our economy, the hedge funds owning everything, and the kind of discipline that is imposed on people by our current state of arrangements.
Yeah.
That stuff isn't talked about in but to do the kind of change on the level we're talking about at the speed we're talking about, we're going to have to talk about what government is for.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a very brief personal family anecdote. In 1943, my grandfather wrote a book with a great lefty named Frank Scott, my grandfather David Lewis, called Make This Your Canada. And it was kind of a popular version of the CCF, the predecessor to the NDP's platform at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the argument that they made in the dying, you know, year and two or two of the Second World War was that basically the government of Canada during the Second World War, there were 28 new public companies that were created during the Second World War. The government essentially summoned the captains of industry into various rooms and said, okay, you are going to produce this over there. You're going to make munitions. You're going to stop making cars and start making tanks or whatever, right? And you're going to pay people this much. The government actually started telling corporations what they could and couldn't do, where and with whom.
Gasp.
Right. And over the course of the Second World War, not, you know, and fighting the existential threat of fascism in Europe,
mm-hmm.
The Canadian economy became much more equal. And the argument that my grandfather and others were making in that time was, look, we essentially had a planned economy in Canada in order to defeat fascism. Now, why wouldn't we use that same tool to defeat poverty? And now today we can say, why wouldn't we use those tools to defeat the threat of catastrophic climate change?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should make us nervous to talk about a federal government with that kind of power. And there are many, many risks involved. But that's what we need to have, that debate about what government is for and what it could actually do. Which leads us to the challenges.
Yes.
Of bringing the Green New Deal to Canada. So let's talk about some of those.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think the first thing I think of is that a relationship between the movement and the electoral sphere is not yet ready or primed, but I think we're getting there.
Yeah, you're seeing new interest in radicals running for office.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we saw it across the country in the last election, 2018. I think we saw it at the trustee level, at the city councilor level, at the MP level.
You mean in the provincial elections and
yes.
In the last year? Yeah.
Yes, in the last
yeah,
year.
True.
In 2019, we already have so many radicals who are either running or planning to run, and that's a very exciting thing. I think what makes us less primed for it is that we don't understand fully yet what those accountability mechanisms between those who want to run or are running and their communities are, and rightfully so.
So when you say accountability mechanism, you mean if they're going to be kind of movement candidates, people coming out of organizing and running for office,
yeah.
How do they not get sucked into the bubble if they get elected? How do they stay
accountable,
yeah.
Yeah, to their promises, and to the work on the ground, right? I think it's we see it all the time. People get swept up into the political sphere, and two things happen. One is that they either let go of the work that was happening on the ground in the first place, or they get burned into nothingness. And we don't want to lose people
no,
to that.
No, we don't.
At
to
all.
Getting burned into nothingness. No.
So there, it kind of goes both ways. It's not because we do the same thing as well, right? We encourage people to run. We say, this is your moment. This is your time. And all you need to do is jump off this cliff. But don't worry, you have a parachute. It's going to be great. And they go, are you going to be there at the end? It's really, it's
we're
like
not
a very,
waiting at the bottom for
we're
people.
We're not waiting at the bottom.
Yeah.
And we abandon people to a lot of really difficult ways of coming out of that or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to figure out, you know, What are your connections to movement work and frontline work? How are you planning on staying accountable to those of us who are going to continue to do this work? And how can we hold you accountable? Mm-hmm. What are the ways that we can get on the phone with you, get in front of cameras with you or behind you or whatever you're going to need?
Maybe beside. Yeah.
And if we're trying to offer people the supports they need during a campaign season, that's also something that we need to talk about,
yep.
You know? Yeah.
So we also have the problem that, like, our economy in Canada is a large part of it is still resource-based. In other words, an extractivist economy. I think there's some good research from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives over the past few years that shows that the resource extraction economy looms larger in our imaginations of what the Canadian economy is than the actual percentage of economic activity that it takes up.
Yeah.
But it's true that for a huge number of communities in Canada, they were established as resource colonies, and they have been, you know, since they've turned into a rust belt or the post-commodity boom ghost towns. We need an offer, a clear offer for what a Green New Deal means for people in Cape Breton, for people in Thunder Bay, for people in extractive communities about what the next economy looks like. And I think that's a challenge and also a huge opportunity. For instance, in Alberta, you and I have both been involved in this project, in supporting this project called Reclaim Alberta.
Yeah. So Reclaim Alberta is this project started by Reagan Boychuk, which is basically aimed at addressing the problem of all of these abandoned oil and gas wells, all this, you know, aging infrastructure, by actually putting Albertans back to work, cleaning it up.
And I think it's a model of what a Green New Deal program could be like.
Absolutely. We have this incredible, unique opportunity to not only, you know, bring people along into what a green economy looks like and ensure that they have work for decades, but also educating people about all the ways we're going to get there. I mean, Reclaim Alberta has produced so much incredible research that's been instrumental in actually showcasing to people what the problems really are at their core and how to build from there.
There is another problem, and I think we've touched on it. It's an important challenge to recognize this idea that only a nation state can really achieve the transition we need at the speed and the scale that we need is a problem for a lot of Indigenous communities who don't recognize the authority of the Crown, of the federal government. Yeah. And that's
only Indigenous communities.
Right, there you go. Right. So it's a non-starter for lots of people who have been leading these movements against pipelines and on climate justice that have brought us to this point.
These are communities, obviously, that need to be centered when we have this collaborative writing process of what this looks like and what it means for so many different folks. And, you know, we need to recognize that those voices need to be heard within the framework of this Green New Deal for Canada.
Do you have any specific hopes around the Green New Deal conversation as we try to both observe it and, frankly, stoke it and push it forward with our work at The Leap and in our other kinds of activism?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of different hopes. The first is that I really hope that the framework of a Green New Deal continues to provide the support that relaunches like Power Shift need to continue to be in existence. They're so incredibly important, right? What they do is they actually spark the conversation of coalition building really young, and they pull people from a whole bunch of different sectors of climate and justice work to talk about what ongoing lifelong collaborative processes look like. And I think that that is a framework that uniquely the Green New Deal provides us to re-enter the conversation and reignite that conversation.
So more disclosure, you're one of the organizers of Power Shift, and you're bringing together...
Oh, thank you. Yes, now that you brought it up.
Hundreds of young people to do like a kind of organizing boot camp in a way.
Yeah, it really is a campaigning boot camp. It's a skill-building boot camp. It's a relationship-building boot camp. We want to go out, bring people together, meet your allies, meet your comrades, meet the people who are going to be on the front lines with you, and talk strategy in advance because... we know everybody else is.
Some of these occasions can give a focus to part of the work.
Yeah, it can absolutely help focus some of it. And I think my second one is that I hope that this actually contributes more intensely to cross-movement solidarity, which is happening, I think, really timidly. I think this frame could start to break that down in a very real way. When we see the framework of the Green New Deal saying the only way we can move forward is if everyone is here at the table, there's much more onus on people to go out and be accountable to each other and bring in the voices that are not present right away. Mm-hmm. So those kind of feed into each other. But those are my hopes. What are some of your hopes for this?
Well, I feel like climate activism is trapped in like a green prison. Mm-hmm. As long as it's seen as an environmental issue, it's just not going to happen. We're not going to have change on the level we need. And so I think the Green New Deal offers the hope of a breakout, of busting out of the green jail, mm-hmm. and actually have this be seen as the incredible, exciting, and inspiring vision of a better life for everyone. I think the language of the deal is really interesting. Deal is like a deeply capitalist word. Yeah. And if you think about, if anybody thinks about what kind of deal they're getting, it's a pretty crap deal that most people are getting right now. If you're a fast food worker, if you're a daycare worker, if you're a farmer, if you're a millennial, then you need a new deal. Mm-hmm. Every constituency deserves a new deal in this system. And I think the language of a new deal could be contagious.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what an anti-capitalist New Deal looks like.
Okay. We've got to work on that one. Messaging team. I feel like we should return to where we started this conversation and the tension between the personal state of emergency that everyone has experienced at some point in their life and how to make that emergency real collectively on a mass basis. And that tension between living in emergency, which so many people do, and having hope for the future, which is contradictory, but at the same time, it's kind of the state of being alive.
Yeah, it is that state of being alive. I think about all the people that it took to keep me alive in the hospital, keep me alive when I got home, make sure, and then, you know, all the storytelling that I did afterwards to make sure that other folks knew what was happening, if this ever happened to them, and how they could survive it, and how we could come together. And it is true that in emergency, we kind of panic, and we cling to something, whatever's closest, a tree, each other.
a crappy job. Notion we're asking people to do a different kind of work in the next economy. That's a leap.
It is a leap. And I think about, you know, what it means to be in emergency and to continue to want to trust each other and trust yourself and to stay steady and firm. And I'm really hopeful that as we come together and as we gather in emergency, that we're looking forward, hopefully with a strategy that means that we can rely on each other no matter what happens.
There's this thing that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said during her election campaign about young women of color seeing someone like her run for office, that you can't be it if you don't see it. And I've thought that this is the case for the future that we're fighting for, that we can't be it if we can't see it. And part of our work is to describe it, that there's a need for to put a little detail on the utopian imagination and actually have a picture of what we're fighting for so that it becomes a real future, a tangible thing that we can picture.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month with a new episode of Change Everything.
In the meantime, we would love to hear your feedback. You can tweet it to us at theleap_org or email it to us at media@theleap.org.
If you want to support the podcast, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, or write us a review on iTunes.
Also, we have a Patreon account, and your financial support will go directly to sustain this podcast. You can find it on the Leap website, theleap.org/change-everything. The link is also in the show notes.
A big thank you to Varshini Prakash, co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, for speaking with us and being our very first guest. This episode of Change Everything was produced by Andrea Schmidt, recorded at Eggplant Picture and Sound in Toronto, and edited and mixed by Jeremy Kessler. Our theme music is by Aluma Music.
Special thanks to Naomi Klein, Leap Co-Executive Director Katie McKenna, and the whole Leap team. Change Everything is produced by The Leap in collaboration with What Escapes Production.